Accession number 10660, Reel 3.
Reverend Steele, Reel 3. You're about to tell me about the Eva Battle dedication service of 1944, please.
That came about because I'd been round, and especially with 79th Div, with what were called the funnies. And it was the flamethrowers which affected me most, because the air burnt. There was this great jet of fluid that came out, and there was a great flash and this huge crackle, which was air burning. And these things were going to be used on the concrete emplacements in Normandy. And I went to see Bimbo Dempsey again and said, "Look, sir, I'm not very happy about having these things without there being some sort of moral control over them, whether it's exercised by you or by Hobo or whoever, because it seems to me that in them lies a great power of revenge. You can let loose troops with these things." And the answer isn't very pleasant. It means you just burn up a lot of Germans. And if you do it deliberately to Germany, then I think we're letting ourselves down. These things are there to win the war with, not to take revenge on an enemy. And he agreed. He said, "Well, what do you think we ought to do?" I said, "Well, my own mind, I think before we go over, is that all those who have any power of authorization of any of the weapons which we're taking over should come and promise to use them for the purpose which is intended." And I said, "What is back of my mind is the service which the knights of old used to hold in the Tower of London, Bath Night, when the new knight to be knighted next day had a bath and then spent the night in the chapel in the Tower of London before his knighthood ceremony the next morning. As if we can find out what sort of service it was, we might be able to build something on." "Oh," he said, "go and see the constable." So I went up to the tower, saw the constable, told him what I wanted, and he was very enthusiastic. But we could find nothing of the services held, save that it seemed to us to have been a sort of time for getting over a wild binge. The best place to put them out of the way was in the chapel, where they wouldn't be a nuisance to anybody else. I said, "Well, we can't use anything here." Went back and told Bimbo. So Bimbo said, "Well, make something up yourself and come and show me what you've done, and then we'll decide." So I put together this service that you got in your hand.
Do you have clear memories of the service itself?
Yes. Just a normal, straightforward service.
Was this the only time, or were there other times when you were concerned about the use of particular weapons?
No, that was the only time that it really got to me.
People often ask me, since I work at the War Museum, mm-hmm. about the question of rules in warfare and the way in which warfare should or should not be done, should not be carried out. Mm-hmm. Some people seem to think that if it's a war, there are no holds barred. What are your own feelings?
Oh, I think there are, for example, gas, of which we had great quantities, was never used. No, I think when we were up against the ordinary Reimarsch, the old sort of chivalry still stood. It was only against the SS that any animosity was really shown.
Did you feel that you had a particular role to play yourself as an army chaplain regarding the morality of the way in which the war was carried out?
Very much so.
Did you find that you got cooperation from senior officers or
not? Yes. Got a lot of cooperation from them.
What are your memories about going across to Europe in 1944?
Well, during the service, a DR arrived and went up to General Dempsey, who called me down, handed it to me, said, read this out at the first appropriate moment. And it was a postponement of D-Day by 24 hours, which I gave out at the service. Otherwise, the original idea was from the service, we were going straight down to the boats in, because that morning the invasion should have taken place. So we were put back 24 hours. And so I arrived on the beaches on the second day. All the things. I drove my car out of the landing craft, and the RAF had softened up the defences by a huge bombing raid. But when the tide was in, of course these bomb craters were filled with water, and being under the sea you couldn't see them. And the next thing I knew, after I'd driven about 20 yards into France, was I was sinking rapidly, and the water was up round by my neck. But the recovery system that we had there, it was absolutely first class. There was a tractor out to me before it stopped sinking, and had a wire onto the buffer and pulled me out. So apart from getting very wet, there's no damage done. And we got into the hills where in the sand dunes, where there was a workshop. And they rewired that car, these leads, that night. And before breakfast, I was able to be on my way with brand new electric wiring, which had been damaged by salt water. So I thought it was absolutely first class too.
Did you have much contact with the French civilians in Normandy?
No. Not a great deal. Except that I got a dog from one. We were in Bridgehead, for nearly 2 months before we broke out. And I was travelling in a jeep on my own along the Capriquet. Bayeux, along that road, and there was a field on my left, and the cattle were streaming round it, and the odd shell of mortar bombs dropping in among them. So I opened the gate, and they rushed out, and the one two left in. I just drove the jeep round the field, out through the gate, got rid of all the cattle, and they went down the road. And I thought, if I'm found with this lot, with all the trouble we've had over looting, I'm for the high jump. So the rest of the things, they turned down a little farm track to the farm yard, and then I went through, and in my Oué la plume de ma tante French, spoke to the farmer and told him that I'd found his vase being bombarded by the German and that I'd brought them out of the field down, and as they'd turned in at this particular opening, I presumed that they were his. Oh, I'd saved his life, I'd saved his cattle, I'd saved his wife, I'd saved everybody. And so we must go and have a drink. So I went in the farmhouse and I had raw Calvados, which is not a drink I can recommend. So he finished a bottle of this stuff, and then he said, now, you must have something for doing all this for me. He said, I know, do you like dogs? And I said, yes, I love dogs. He said, well, my spaniel has just had puppies. Will you have a puppy? And I said, certainly I'll have a puppy. And so this wretched dog was brought in, this little tiny pup. And I took it away with me, and it went all the way through to the end of the war with me. And then I had to leave it in Germany when I came home. But it was brought back by somebody, because my driver during the war was driving a big Rolls Royce with a very fat and prosperous looking gentleman sitting in the back. And I was walking down the mall, and the car was on the other side of it. It roared across through the mall, upset all the traffic, and out came my driver waving a paper. He said, look, sir, William's home. But we'd call the little dog William, William and Nominee. And somebody had brought him back, and he was in quarantine kennels at Southampton.
Do you think the Norman civilians were glad to be liberated, or did you feel that they were in two minds about it?
Oh, I think they were pleased to have us. What did they object to was the fact that they couldn't go to their market because we hadn't captured that. And they rather resented our slowness in getting through to the market centres at Caen and whatnot, so they could sell their produce. As it was, they had to sell it to us at our own price. And no, their butter was absolutely lovely.
Didn't we give them such a good price as the Germans?
I shouldn't think so.
Can you tell me about what your own memories as the Northwest Europe campaign developed and you went through France and the Low Countries?
Yes. From the moment we started the chase after we got to Falaise, well, I think I saw one of the worst sights of the whole of the war. It affected me even more than Belsen. That was a German army destroyed from Falaise to Sonis, 21 miles. A German army had been trapped. And Canadian guns on the left of it, and tanks on the south of it, had blocked the end of the road and the one leading in. And this army was nose to tail and was attacked by the Canadian guns, our own armour, and the Typhoon, which I think was the most telling aircraft in that war. And I had to drive down it. And it was nothing but German corpses. I always remember one at one of these funny little culvert bridges, you know, with the three pipe bars. And there was a German on one with one leg on the bottom rung of the thing, the other leg just over the top rung, and he was frozen, stiff, with his hands on the thing. He'd been hit in the back of the neck by one of the Typhoon bullets, and he'd frozen in death. And he was there in that Falaise for about 4 days. But one day was a Sunday, because I remember going down, and the French people with their kids were walking along, spitting at all of what they call the salvage, which I thought was a bit unnecessary. Yes, saying salvation, spitting at them.
At the corpses?
At the corpses. It was a dreadful mess. And even Belsen didn't affect me like that did.
Did you see any German wounded?
No. There were no wounded left. The whole thing with the horses were probably the thing which affected me most. Because a lot of the German transport was horsed. They had very few lorries.
What was the appearance of the horses?
Oh, dead. The legs sticking up in the air and getting bloated as each day went by. Oh, that was the end of the German army of Normandy. That's where it finished up. Very few of them got away.
What happened to you personally after the Falaise breakthrough?
Went on. Next stop was Brussels.
You didn't go into Paris?
No. No, we went La Roche-Guyon over the Seine. Ivre, Arras, Brussels. We were advancing on a front only 600 yards wide.
Were you there when Brussels was liberated?
Yes.
Can you describe that?
Well, mostly crowds who got in our way. It's the exact reverse to what had happened in the early days when the bus broke through. The refugees on the roads held up the movement of our own troops. And here it was again, only this time not with fright, but with genuine joy at seeing us.
Did you have any conversation with the inhabitants of Brussels about what they'd been through?
No, not that day. I didn't stop him at all. I went straight through to a little place called Solis, where our headquarters were set up.
Can you remember what happened to you next?
Well, one of the things we'd been after, owing to this mad rush across Europe, was the flying bombs. We'd got to put those out of action. Then, of course, the V2 started, and they were much more difficult. There's nothing built on the ground for the firing of those things. And the first I knew about them was in the big reed lakes, which were full of duck. And we'd got Dickie Richards, who was in charge of Ordnance and War Office, to send us out a few shotguns and enough cartridges to keep us going for a bit. On the grounds at the ammunition dumps between Sonis and Eindhoven were in danger from the savage canards of that area. And
savage canards?
Yes, wild duck. And they thought it was German secret society. And so these things were rushed out to us. The first night we went out to this pool, we'd all taken up our position as little hides, when suddenly in the middle of the pool there's a most mighty flash and a tidal wave that sort of came and knocked us flat on our backs. And we got up, shook ourselves, and heard what we thought was another one coming. It was the noise of the first one that had already arrived. And when we got back to Army headquarters, the duck shooting, of course, was ruined entirely, altogether. The duck departed and never came back. And then we heard about the V2s. One fell just outside the Scotch castle which we were living in at Sarnis. And the policeman on duty, traffic duty, at the corner with the driveway down to the Scotch, was completely stripped. Every bit of clothing torn off him. This thing burst by, I suppose, about 100 yards from him. And the trouble was that these V2s were very unreliable. They were apt to go up and turn down, come straight down to where they'd come from. And that was the two that we had near us. They were fired a matter of a mile away from us. Had gone up and turned and come down. Only unfortunately they came down way near where I was. And they were dreadful weapons.
Whereabouts was this?
A little place called Sonis, outside Brussels, about 15 miles out.
Do you remember going into the Netherlands?
I went up for... I would stay with the Guards Armored Division for the Arnhem Bridge. And I got up as far as a little place called Elst, which is about 3 miles from the bridge, where the Welsh Guards had taken over. And there's an aerial fight going on, miles away above us. And you just see the vapor trails, that was about all. And then suddenly was a great big flash, and one of the planes blew up. And out of it fell a figure. In the parachute. It came down and it turned out he was a Saxon flying a 109. And the Welsh Guards didn't know what to do with this fella. So they said, well, you've got a jeep, there's plenty of room, go along with you. I said, all right, I'll take him down to the nearest POW camp and dump him in there. And he talked very little English, very broken. But he'd been told that the bridge at Nimeguen had been blown. And when we started to run up the incline to it, he was convinced and was almost jumping out of the jeep, thinking we were going to fall in the water. And then when we got over to the other side, he said, oh, well, it must be another bridge. This is not the right bridge, this is, must be another one. I said, there's no other one, this is the only one that goes over the river. Oh no, he wouldn't believe it. So I pulled in at the headquarters of the ECEC, defences of the bridge, and the brigadier said, come and have a cup of tea, John. And I said, thanks very much. What about your friend? I said, oh, that fellow's no friend of mine. I said, he's come out of the sky. Dropped in among the Welsh Guards who were given to me to put in a prisoner of war camp. He said, you got you armed? And I said, no. He says, I've got the dog there. There's this spaniel pup. I said, he'll look after him. No, that won't do. And so two huge gunners were called who stood over this little tiny frightened fella with Bren guns and very reluctant to let me go on a booth. Down to, towards Eindhoven, where there was a prisoner of war camp. As I found it quite easily off the side of the road, drove up to the gate and called the guard over. I said, here, take this fella. Said, I don't want him any more. You put him away. He said, have you got any particulars about him? I said, no, not a thing. I said, I saw him shot down up near Arnhem. And he fell amongst the Welsh Guards, who liberated him. So I said, there's nothing for you to look for. He hasn't got anything left in the way of watches or whatnot. So I left him there. And I never heard any more about him.
Did you see what condition the Dutch were in?
They weren't too bad. They weren't too bad at all.
They were
very helpful.
Did you have anything more to do with the Arnhem campaign operation?
No. No, it was an impossible situation. The road was higher than the surrounding land, and the 88 from by Arnhem, any tank which went down the road towards the bridge was knocked out straight away with the 88s. Couldn't move, and the ground lower down was too soft. They sank in too far to move and manipulate a big tank.
Did you know anything about what was happening at the bridge at Arnhem?
No, save that a lot of airborne troops had been captured.
What other memories have you got of the Netherlands, if any?
The Netherlands, only the bridge across, which we put with boats, which the Navy and Remy together fixed and went across. What used to amuse me, I used to go up there, probably every other day, to have a look at these lads. German was very methodical. At 11 o'clock he would shell. So at 5 to 11 everybody put down whatever work they were doing and went into the various shelters. And then Bosch would start to shell the bridge, which was slowly creeping across the river. Because there it was over a mile wide. And as soon as 11:10 came, when they stopped, all the lead used to dash out into these little assault craft with outboard engines to pick up the dead fish which the shelling had caused in the river. And they were sure...